Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, Director of the Northwestern University Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman of Vocalo.org, 89.5 FM.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
We have two experts here today to talk to us about the theory that earthquakes can be triggered by dams and reservoirs, which has been in the news since the Wenchuan earthquake. On May 12, 2008, an earthquake of magnitude 7.9 struck Wenchuan in Sichuan Province, a mountainous area in western China. More than 80,000 people were reported to have been killed, as large numbers of buildings, including apartments and schools, collapsed because of the earthquake and subsequent landslides.
A number of news articles have appeared since then linking the earthquake to the nearby Zipingpu Dam and its reservoir. This concrete dam, 156 meters high, was completed in 2004, and the water level in the reservoir had risen to 120 meters. As is normal, the level was dropped as water was released in the dry season in the winter and spring of 2008. These articles suggested that this massive earthquake was triggered by the dam and the changing water levels in the reservoir behind it. With us today are two experts on earthquakes and dams. Seth Stein is William Deering Professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Northwestern University. His research focuses on investigating plate boundary processes and deformation within the lithosphere, which means he spends a lot of time studying earthquakes. Professor Charles Dowding is Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northwestern. He's a geotechnical engineer who studies earth as a building material and ways to ensure the integrity of structures in the face of ground movements, natural and man-made. Seth and Chuck, thanks very much for joining us today to talk about this interesting connection or possible connection between large dams and reservoirs and earthquake. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, and I have Chuck Dowding here. Chuck, would you say hello?
Hi, Seth.
So a starting point is this connection real? Is it possible that a large built facility can cause an earthquake?
Yeah, we think it is. There have been a number of cases of this phenomenon that we know of. The first documented one was about 1967 in India. And since then, people got interested in that question, and there's been a lot of research on it. Basically, cause is probably not the word you want. The word you want is trigger. In other words, you have to have a fault there. It has to be relatively close to being in a position that it wants to go. And under those conditions, calculations suggest that this can happen, and empirically it does seem to happen often. I mean, not every day. There's a lot of dams out there without earthquakes, but it looks like under the right conditions, you can trigger an earthquake.
Seth, don't you think it would be a good idea to share with the listeners what we mean by earthquakes, because there's such a wide variety of them?
Well, here what we're mostly talking about are the relatively rare cases where we have a large earthquake. You often will have small things associated with the filling of a dam. Here we're talking about a situation where a dam and the reservoir it produces are close enough to a major fault that it triggers motion on the fault. It's the straw that breaks the camel's back on a fault that was already there and fairly close to breaking anyway. So in this case, we had, for example, a very large fault, the Wenchuan Fault, which is at the edge of the Tibetan Plateau, where the border between the Tibetan Plateau and the Sichuan Basin, which is the flatter part of China. So ever since, for about 40 million years, India has been pushing north into Asia, pushing Tibet out of the way, pushing Tibet over the main part of China. That's been going on for millions of years. We think that motion on that fault now is about 2 millimeters a year, which means that every few thousand years, maybe 5,000 years, we might expect an earthquake of this size.
So 2 millimeters a year in your science is small.
It's moderate, I guess. It's about the same motion that gives rise to the earthquakes that we sometimes see in Utah. It's about somewhere between a 20th to a 25th of what we see on the San Andreas.
Could you share with the listeners some more about the magnitude of the earthquakes and how they vary in size?
You know, when this is if this is reservoir induced, it will be the biggest reservoir induced earthquake that we know of. The ones that we've put most of our attention into in the past of these sorts were about magnitude 6 to 6.5, 6.7, something like that. So this is a very big earthquake. These things are not that common on that fault, as near as we can tell.
So this was a 7.9 earthquake, and in terms of the amount of energy that's involved, what's the difference between the smaller earthquake that you just described and the one in China?
Every magnitude unit corresponds to about a factor of 30 in the energy.
So this was a big earthquake.
This was a very big earthquake. It's as big as, let's say, anything we've ever known on the San Andreas.
If this was an area that was known to have some geological pressure on it, should there have been precautions taken when the construction was done?
It's hard to say. China has lots and lots of areas that have earthquakes, a lot of which you probably would have ranked higher, that there was more motion on. So the answer is probably yes, but there's a lot of, you know, it's a big country and there's a lot of earthquake hazard all over the place.
If they were going to take precautions, what sort of precautions might be taken in a case like that?
Well, the problem, you know, there's two parts. I mean, one of them is dealing with the stability of the dam itself, and the dams, you know, that seemed to have been okay. Chuck can talk more about there was some damage to it, but the dams are okay. I mean, in the abstract, you'd say this is a lousy place to build a dam, but the problem that one always faces is this. You want to build dams where there's steep mountains or steep valleys or something to impound a lot of water. That's the places where you tend to have faults. So the places, by and large, where you'd most like to put a dam are the places where you're most likely to find things that could cause problems for it, sort of anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Same things that make a dam spot desirable often make it geologically less desirable.
Chuck?
Well, Seth did mention the fact that the dam itself didn't suffer extensive damage. Most dams are designed to withstand earthquakes given the earthquake history of the region. And as Seth indicated, this region does have significant earthquake activity, but not as severe as that in other places in China. So typical standard procedures would involve designing the dams to withstand significant displacements.
So how do you do that? How is the design of that dam different than some dam that's in a more benign area?
Well, it would be necessary to for instance, one could consider it an earth-filled dam as being much more possibly deformable than a very rigid, narrow arch dam, which would not be a very good idea. I think this is a concrete gravity dam, at least what I could see from the aerial photographs, although I don't know for sure if that's the case. I did want to indicate that there is one other thing that would be done, and this is what's under consideration for a dam in California where this controversy has erupted, Auburn Dam. Well, it would be necessary to install a very dense seismographic array around that particular area to determine the base level of the seismic emissions, and then when the dam was built, to monitor the seismic emissions from the dam as it was filled and emptied. And therefore, it might be possible to look at the periodicity of the small motions that were generated during filling and emptying of the reservoir. And there's a good deal of experience that indicates that part of the triggering mechanism might have something to do with the rapidity of either filling or emptying the reservoir behind the dams itself. And so therefore, one could use a monitoring system to monitor that and also build maybe a series of dams that would prevent this seasonally induced rapid filling of the dam or rapid emptying of the dam could be moderated by building a system of dams that would prevent that from happening.
And you might want to include that in your strategy for filling the dam.
Exactly.
Because obviously the biggest changes happen when you fill the dam. I mean, let's put it this way. There are reservoirs all along faults all over the world. The same reasons it's a natural race to put a reservoir. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be, one tends to assume that the biggest changes happen during the filling of the dam. And as Chuck said, that's kind of a standard practice now when you build a major dam, is you'll install a seismic network and monitor the changes that you see. In fact, a lot of what we know about this process comes from those kinds of seismic networks.
So what do we do with the information we get from that seismic network? Does that affect the way we manage the water supply in the dam?
You know, I really don't know operationally how, in the past, you know, the stuff was much less real time. I suspect these days it would. A lot of interest in this during the period, you know, there was a period in the 70s when there was a lot of extensive dam building, and I guess in the U.S., at least, there hasn't been that much major dam building.
Well, there were seismic emissions that were monitored after the construction of Hoover Dam, which impounds Lake Mead. And interestingly enough, those very small earthquakes ceased to occur when Lake Powell was constructed. So that may lend credence to the systematic design of a series of reservoirs to ameliorate or perhaps make less concentrated whatever stress concentrations might be imposed on any fault system.
And is the science that exists today sufficient to perform that kind of balancing act where if you do one thing, you can do a counterbalancing other thing?
Well, we're being more and more able to do this as our computing capacity increases. This is a three-dimensional, multi-parameter, multi-material problem that needs to be addressed. We'll need very large computers to actually model this precisely enough to actually make some advances on this particular area. But I'm relatively confident, given the logarithmic growth in computing capacity and the logarithmic decline in its cost, that this certainly is well within our grasp. Wouldn't you agree, Seth?
Absolutely. I think our understanding of this phenomenon and how to address it and what we need to do to think about it is a heck of a lot further along than it was 20 years ago. You know, like the Auburn Dam, we were arguing about that in the 80s. But at the time, we just didn't really know anywhere near as much about how to model this and how to describe it as we do now. The thing about it is that it's a common rare event, I guess, is what you'd want to think about it. In other words, there's large numbers of dams out there in the world. Most of them don't seem to have this problem. Some of them do. Some of you want to think about.
But when they do occur, they're of such magnitude that it becomes an intense global issue. And it's sort of like a large airplane crash, like Air France.
I do not know that any of these have actually caused the failure of a dam, as far as I know.
Correct.
Yeah, it's interesting. But Seth, the way you started describing this, it sounds like this was an earthquake waiting to happen.
For this to happen, this is why I keep coming back to this word triggering. The general thinking is this has to be an earthquake pretty much ready to happen. But that could be geologically. It might be 100 years. It might be, you know, something like that. But in other words, if, let's put it this way, hypothetically, because we can calculate what we think are the stress changes associated with the filling of a reservoir, and they're not very large. So we have to be the fault has to be pretty close to ready to go. That's where my point about the straw breaking the camel's back comes in. What probably happened here was we think it's been at least 1,500 years since we had an earthquake of this size on that fault, and maybe a lot longer. I would have guessed a lot longer. And so the stress had just been building up very, very slowly over thousands of years.
And when Seth describes that these are small stress changes, one of the people who's been calculating these things also has calculated stress changes for other man-induced earthquakes, and the stress changes are in the 4 decimal point area. So they are exceedingly small, and I would maintain that our knowledge of the materials themselves is not that precise.
The way to think about it is that people who are skeptical of these arguments, if I touched you on the forehead with my finger lightly, that would be about the stress that we're dealing with, okay? And it's surprising, I would say, most of us were extremely skeptical that this would be large enough to induce earthquakes, trigger earthquakes, although it seems more and more when we look around the world that that does seem to be the case. So, I mean, this has been a surprise to many of us, but the phenomenon does seem to happen.
So is it a case where the science is catching up with the empirical evidence?
Yeah, I mean, there's an old geologist line that says that anything that did happen can happen. And so, absent the observations of the earthquakes, had you come out and propounded the idea that filling a dam could cause an earthquake, I think most of us would have said that's ridiculous. It's much too small.
You mean a major earthquake.
It looks like it happened. People have said, okay, it looks like it's real.
I would agree with Seth. I think the discussion has matured over the years. And early on, after the earthquake associated with Orville Dam filling in California, there was intense discussion, many people on both sides of the issue. I think most people would now agree that filling reservoirs does certainly induce very small earthquakes almost in many, many dams that are constructed. The real issue then becomes, you know, what happens to stresses on relatively faults that are capable of inducing large earthquakes at relatively large distances away from the reservoir itself, relative to the size of the reservoir. And I think that's where this discussion needs more clarification.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, one of the things is you're never really going to be able to say that a big earthquake, that filling a reservoir caused the big earthquake. You can make a pretty good case for the small earthquakes because there you can track the changes in the lake level and the small earthquakes. The big ones, you know, you're doing some calculations, it's plausible, the timing seems plausible, but you're never going to be dealing with a huge enough set of data to be absolutely sure of it.
So I'm thinking, my understanding from what I hear both of you saying is that it would be unreasonable to say somebody should have predicted this.
If someone would have been able to say, well, I don't know, suppose an intelligent statement would have been, well, maybe there's a 0.5% chance or something like that this would happen. And, you know, you can what do you do with a statement?
Well, I'm not sure, but it leads me to ask what I think is a related question, and that is, so where do we stand on the development of an ability to predict earthquakes?
We generally suspect that it's probably not going to be possible. Enormous efforts have gone into this, and the current thinking is based on two things. One of them is that, as near as we can tell, nothing special happens in the Earth before an earthquake. If we monitor the physical properties of the ground, we've been trying to do this for, I don't know, maybe 50 years, and we've never seen much of anything happen before an earthquake. In other words, A, we haven't succeeded in doing it. B, what we're thinking increasingly, although you can never be sure, is that probably what happens is that, if you remember the Jurassic Park where they're explaining chaos theory, and the idea is that a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil can trigger a tornado in Texas. Namely, very small changes can sometimes make things happen, but usually don't. So our thinking right now is that probably on a major fault, you know, every day there are micro earthquakes. You know, what a small fraction of those grow into tiny earthquakes. A small fraction of those grow into little earthquakes. A small fraction of those grow into moderate-sized earthquakes, and so on and so forth. So it's such a random process that we suspect the Earth doesn't know when the next earthquake is coming, except like on the order of a few hundred years. And if the Earth doesn't know, it can't tell us.
So if that's the case, Chuck, what do we do when we think about planning and building infrastructure? Do we stay away from these places, or do we do the design differently?
Well, in terms of building dams, you mean, in terms of the infrastructure?
Well, or building any, I suppose I'm thinking about it also from the point of view that Seth described a process whereby the dam or filling and emptying the reservoir triggers an earthquake. But if we're not able to anticipate earthquakes in specific terms, what about all the other infrastructure that's at risk when an earthquake happens? Should we move out of San Francisco?
Well, that's a very complicated question. I think we have to develop systems that are more flexible, systems that are not rigid, systems that, in fact, assume that failure will occur, especially if you live in California. I think if you live in California, you have to accept the fact that earthquakes will occur. Whatever civil infrastructure we design has to be designed to accommodate that. And there are procedures for doing that for a wide range of civil infrastructure that have been adopted.
The people who do this sort of stuff have been thinking in these terms for a long time. For example, I mean, there's a real simple example is when the California Aqueduct enters the Los Angeles Basin, it comes in as an open canal rather than a pipe, simply because it will be easier to fix. So basically, there's two parts of it. There's designing those things that for survivability, and then a certain number of things they also have been designing for repairability.
Right. There, for instance, in terms of survivability, a new tunnel was just excavated through the Hayward Fault for water conveyance, and it was specifically designed to accommodate feet of displacement at the Hayward Fault, the tunnel itself, as was, say, for the Alaska pipeline. Do you want to go ahead and give them the example?
Yeah, I think that was truly a very impressive accomplishment. The pipeline, it crosses the Denali Fault, which you can think of as basically the San Andreas. It had an earthquake of the same size as the Beichuan earthquake a couple years ago. The pipeline had been designed, and Chuck could go into detail as to how that's been done. The pipeline was designed to survive, not just survive, but to function. And it was the triumph of pipeline engineering. The thing worked quite unaffected by this major earthquake, which occurred right under it. I mean, it crossed the Denali Fault.
Let me see if I explain this. If you can think of a large number of railroad tracks parallel to the fault itself, and the pipeline would be on the surface on top of these railroad tracks, but it would curve its way along the railroad tracks so that if the railroad tracks moved, the pipe could expand and contract in a flexible fashion to take whatever displacement, either parallel to the fault or perpendicular to the fault or vertical with respect to the fault. And it worked perfectly during this earthquake. You know, earthquakes produce two types of response in the ground. They shake the ground, and they also can, the zone of fault rupture can permanently displace the ground. And that permanent displacement, of course, is far more harmful to any civilian infrastructure than the shaking displacement itself.
So can you contrast the way we're building, let's say, in the United States today in the earthquake-prone zones, and particularly in California, with what you know or what you believe to be the case in developing parts of the world like Western China or Northern India or in Pakistan and other places which are very much earthquake-prone and where we hear about large death tolls as a consequence of earthquakes? Are they doing something different than we're doing?
Well, I think one has to look at different levels of infrastructure construction. If we think about the major components to the infrastructure, I think that design approaches are relatively uniform around the world, where people belong to earthquake engineering societies and whatnot, share papers with the speed of light almost. And the people who are designing these things are all very well educated, very highly attuned to the literature and the experience that we share. And then, of course, I'll go to the other end of the pole, and that is the person on the street and how well the building codes enforce wise earthquake construction approaches. And I think those are going to vary much more highly than are going to be the design approaches for constructing major infrastructure components. We know that much of the developing world has to rely upon cementitious materials for construction and really winds up building too large a percentage of its housing stock with unreinforced masonry, which, of course, is very susceptible to earthquake shaking.
Just to ask about a specific occurrence of the Viat Dam, the landslide that happened there, and there's a belief that that was a triggered landslide rather than being the result of an earthquake. Is that an opinion that you share?
Well, this has been the prevailing opinion in the literature for many, many decades. In fact, the landslide that was triggered by the filling of that reservoir was observed during construction of the roads to build the reservoir itself. So it was under movement for significant periods of time, even before the reservoir began filling. The unfortunate part was that people didn't realize the fact that it could fail catastrophically and basically produce almost a mini tsunami, which would wash itself over the top of the reservoir, taking away the engineers on site at that time, and then I think causing 3,000 deaths below. But basically, that failure, while producing a tsunami, which is also sometimes produced by an earthquake, the tsunami was actually produced by the landslide mass catapulting or sliding down into the reservoir itself.
Do you know what caused the land to move in the first place?
Well, as we probably all know and understand, reservoirs are best built in topography that is highly variable with steep sides to canyons and all, which are the places where landslide erosion is occurring most rapidly. And this landslide that was induced by the reservoir filling was a historical landslide that had been initiated many, many, many years before and basically was in a state of imminent failure as the reservoir was being constructed.
And the reason for an indentation like that in between cliffs is a natural place because it contains the water naturally? Is that why reservoirs are likely to be built in a varied topography, like you said?
Correct. Reservoirs are generally built, the dam itself is built in the strongest part of the stream valley that one can find, wherein there's sufficient volume behind the dam itself to impound the amount of water that's necessary. Basically, what's necessary is as much as you can possibly impound turns out to be the right design value for that. So therefore, one is concerned about both depth and width being important. In the case of Viat, it was primarily a power generation dam itself, and so they were looking for high head differences, so you'd want to locate the dam high above the power generating facilities in a valley even further below.
High head meaning the water's way above, so it gets a lot of velocity as it comes down and generates more power?
Yes.
And you mentioned earlier that, I think you said an earth-filled dam was more suited to sustain movement in the earth because it's more flexible than concrete. Is that right?
Well, if one could compare, say, a gravity earthen dam, which would be very wide at the bottom and relatively wide at the top, to a thin arch double curvature dam, which could not sustain very significant deformation, the thicker, more deformable earthen dam could sustain that permanent deformation. Now, of course, one needs to construct the earthen dam such that there no destabilization of the earth fill itself occurs during the earthquake. So that's another design challenge. Now, I assume that that would be done properly, but that's a design challenge for building, say, an earthen dam.
So this is a very interesting case. I mean, when reading the popular literature, it seemed like there was a growing certainty as to the causal link between the, people say the dam, but apparently the filling and lowering of the reservoir and the earthquake itself. But what I've learned today is that it's a softer, less certain link than we had thought about. The notion of triggering, I think, is something we want to take away to help us understand the mechanism. And from what I'm hearing from both of you, is it sounds like the knowledge of natural processes and materials and design and in the end, management of the infrastructure are at once essential for understanding and dealing with these situations. And at the same time, knowledge in all those fields is growing, and perhaps that'll give us a safer future as we look forward.
I was actually looking at the paper here in front of me, and the authors said very carefully, they said, the stress increased is above the threshold generally regarded as sufficient to tip the balance toward earthquake occurrence on critically stressed fault. In other words, if the fault were critically stressed, i.e. it was close to failure, then the filling of the dam would probably have been enough to make that happen. But we don't, you know, there's a series of things in there that one doesn't know.
So all the factors have to come together to make this happen.
It's like all disasters, you know, disasters of any sort generally result from a set of relatively, you know,
multiple causes,
multiple factors right. happening to hit you in the face.
Well, you've both helped us understand these multiple causes, and we appreciate the time you spent in talking to us today. Thank you very much, Professor Seth Stein, Professor Charles Dowding. Appreciate your being with us. Thank you.
Glad to do it.
Happy to be here.